Chapter 3. Exemplars. I bid him look into the lives of men as in a glass, and to take example from other persons. Terence, the Brothers. Beyond his own, no other family exerted a greater influence on George Washington than the Fairfaxes. At the top of the family stood Thomas, 6th Lord Fairfax, Baron of Cameron and proprietor of the Northern Neck, a huge swath of Virginia real estate located between the Rappahannock and the Potomac. His lordship inherited the proprietary upon his mother's death in 1719. He remained in England initially, preferring to hire a series of agents to manage the Northern Neck. Their primary duties involved granting vacant lands and assessing annual quitrents. Robert King Carter served as the proprietary agent for a long time, but after his death in 1732, Lord Fairfax needed a new agent. He had trouble finding a capable manager, but eventually chose William Fairfax, a cousin living in Massachusetts. After a hitch in the army, William Fairfax had been devoting himself to public service in the British colonies. He served as Chief Justice of the Bahamas, but its hot weather drained his energy and made him sickly. He transferred to Massachusetts, where he served as collector of customs at Salem from 1725 until 1734, when his cousin approached him about becoming the Virginia agent. William Fairfax accepted the position and relocated to Virginia. Lord Fairfax exerted his influence to help his cousin become collector of customs for the South Potomac district as well. Unlike the Bahamas, Virginia agreed with William Fairfax, and he settled into the comfortable life of a colonial Virginia gentleman. He became lieutenant colonel of the county militia, a position entitling him, like so many other Virginia gentlemen, to be styled colonel. Broadening his political influence, he was elected to the House of Burgesses and ultimately appointed to the Virginia Council. Colonel Fairfax built an imposing Georgian mansion in Fairfax County on the south shore of the Potomac River and named it Belvoir. Located near Mount Vernon, it became a frequent destination for young Washington. Belvoir lived up to its name. It was a beautiful home with a beautiful view. A high and commanding ground, Washington said. 40 years later, he recalled his time at Belvoir with nostalgia. "The happiest moments of my life had been spent there," he reflected. Practically every room in the place brought to Washington's mind the recollection of pleasing scenes. The extravagance of the mansion's interior matched the grandeur of its exterior. Belvoir's spacious, high-studded rooms were adorned with rich imported furnishings. Mahogany abounded. Colonel Fairfax's beautiful furniture symbolized his wealth and taste, but one element of the decor at Belvoir had greater resonance. A bust of Shakespeare reflected his love of literature. Belvoir's fine library provided another way for Colonel Fairfax to display his literary tastes to his guests. A library can do much more than decorative sculpture can. Not only does a well-stocked library symbolize its owner's passion for literature, it also provides a way to gratify that passion. Containing geographies, histories, law books, and works on commerce, horticulture, and travel, the library at Belvoir revealed Colonel Fairfax's wide-ranging intellectual interests. The keen-eyed and quick-witted traveler Andrew Burnaby, who met the family during his stay in Virginia, observed that Colonel Fairfax had a competent knowledge not only of the classics but of the modern languages. The books at Belvoir verify Burnaby's observation. Colonel Fairfax owned an English-Latin dictionary, a Latin-French dictionary, and a Spanish-English dictionary. His collection also included a copy of Giles Jacobs' New Law Dictionary, an authoritative legal reference that could be found in the libraries of many colonial American lawyers. A 700-page folio, Jacobs' dictionary was a hefty work. An 18th-century British novelist has a character defend himself by wielding a copy of Jacob's Dictionary as a cudgel. Colonel Fairfax also owned a copy of another sturdy reference work, John Harris's Lexicon Technicum, or An Universal English Dictionary of Arts and Sciences. Though called a dictionary, Harris's work more closely resembles an encyclopedia. One of the first books demonstrating the significance of Newtonian science, Harris's Lexicon is considered the earliest English encyclopedia. It formed the prototype for the more famous encyclopedias from across the English Channel that emerged during the Enlightenment. Harris found illustrations essential to his Lexicon Technicum and criticized other lexicographers for omitting them. Though numerous, the illustrations in Lexicon Technicum give it a curious appearance. They can be subdivided into two basic types: diagrams of mathematical and mechanical proofs and illustrations of heraldic symbols. Harris implicitly equates the ability to read a geometric proof and the ability to read a coat of arms, reinforcing the traditional connection between knowledge and class. Impressed with this encyclopedic work, Washington would add a copy of Harris's Lexicon to his own library. His copy remained in the Washington family until Willis P. Hazard, a Pennsylvania antiquarian, acquired it at auction in 1876. The volume changed hands several times since, but it is now returned to Mount Vernon. In a letter pasted inside its front cover, Hazard goes to great lengths to demonstrate that the book did indeed come from Washington's library, though it lacks the telltale autograph and bookplate. Hazard neglected other evidence of Washington's ownership in the volume. Several entries in the Mount Vernon copy of Harris's Lexicon are annotated in Washington's hand. Though brief, these annotations show Washington's mind at work. The entry for lever, for instance, begins, "Lever is the second mechanical power, and so considered is only a balance supported by a hypomacleon." The last word gave Washington pause, but only for a moment. He quickly realized that Harris's Lexicon itself contained the answer, and turned back several leaves to the H section and looked up the word. In the field of mechanics, Washington learned, a hypomacleon was a prop placed under a lever to give it leverage, in short, a fulcrum. The word prop was more commonly used in Harris's time than fulcrum. After reading the entry for hypomacleon, Washington turned back to the L section and wrote prop in the margin adjacent to the entry for lever, clarifying what the word hypomacleon meant. Washington did not stop there. It was not enough for him to learn these basic mechanical terms. He also wanted to understand the mathematics underlying them. He turned to the M section and read Mechanics. This article contains an illustration showing the placement of a fulcrum beneath a lever and contrasting the travel of one arm of the lever with the distance traveled by the other. To help himself understand the mathematics, Washington annotated the diagram, identifying the arcs, or spaces, inscribed by both arms of the lever. Some of the books from Colonel Fairfax's collection Washington read at Belvoir. Others he brought to Mount Vernon, where he read them at his leisure. The copy of William Leybourne's Complete Surveyor Washington read was Fairfax's copy. He found the book so useful that he hesitated to return it. Cataloging the Mount Vernon Library years later, Washington discovered that he still possessed Fairfax's copy of Leybourne. Other books he borrowed from Belvoir, he returned more promptly. Beyond what he learned from reading individual volumes in Colonel Fairfax's library, Washington saw how a man's books could reflect his personality. The Belvoir Library displayed the Colonel as a sophisticated and cultured gentleman, someone involved in local politics, but aware of the world at large, in touch with the present, but cognizant of the past. He was not a lawyer, but he had a good understanding of the law, good enough to serve him in his role as justice on the bench of the General Court of Virginia. He was not a clergyman, but he had a good understanding of divinity. His scientific knowledge was mainly practical. He knew what he needed to cultivate his garden. He had a healthy curiosity about political and economic theory, but sometimes enjoyed poetry. In short, the colonel's broad intellectual outlook gave Washington an attitude to emulate. Given the proximity of Belvoir and Mount Vernon, close ties developed between the Fairfaxes and the Washingtons. Lawrence Washington married Colonel Fairfax's daughter Anne. Two of her brothers, George William and Bryan, became good friends with George Washington. George William Fairfax's wife, Sarah, Sally, also became close friends with George Washington. A little too close, some said. But Colonel Fairfax, more than any other family member, was responsible for giving George Washington the chance to better himself. Washington's friendship with the colonel confirms Burnaby's impression. Mr. William Fairfax was a gentleman of very fine accomplishments and general good character. He was a kind husband, an indulgent parent, a faithful friend, a sincere Christian, and was eminently distinguished for his private and public virtues. Indebted to Colonel Fairfax's friendship, Washington recommended to his brother Jack that he make friends with the family. George's advice reveals his own relationship with the colonel. I should be glad to hear that you live in perfect harmony and good fellowship with the family at Belvoir, as it is in their power to be very serviceable upon many occasions to us as young beginners. I would advise your visiting there often as one step towards it. The rest, if any more is necessary, your own good sense will sufficiently dictate. For to that family I am under many obligations, particularly to the old gentleman. Colonel Fairfax approached his position as land agent for the Northern Neck with the responsibility it demanded, something his predecessor, King Carter, had not always done. As his regal nickname suggests, Carter had a voracious appetite for land, which led him into some irresponsible and unscrupulous practices when it came to managing the proprietary. When his surveyors located good tracts of land, Carter patented them in his name or his children's. Colonel Fairfax carried out his responsibilities as land agent more diligently, but ran into problems due to the disputed boundaries of the proprietary. Lord Fairfax persuaded the Privy Council in London to order a survey that would settle the boundary dispute once and for all. The survey concluded that the lands under his lordship's control amounted to more than 5 million acres, around twice as much land than previously assumed. Many found this startling conclusion hard to accept. Lord Fairfax spent 8 years pressing his case before the Board of Trade and the Privy Council, which finally upheld the survey's conclusions in 1745. 2 years later, he emigrated to Virginia, moved in with his cousin at Belvoir, and began overseeing the proprietary himself. Since Lord Fairfax's responsibilities as proprietor involved granting vacant land throughout the Northern Neck, he created a considerable need for surveyors, an ideal situation for George Washington, who first met his lordship at Belvoir. Impressed with this ambitious teen, Fairfax encouraged him to pursue his surveying career. Washington subsequently helped survey and map two properties in the Shenandoah Valley where Lord Fairfax settled, Greenway Court and Leeds Manor. These names pay homage to his aristocratic heritage. Lord Fairfax named Greenway Court after a small holding in Kent, which the family had used as a retreat, and Leeds Manor echoes the name of the castle where he was born. Washington was impressed. Like his cousin, Lord Fairfax gave Washington an example of a prosperous and cultured country gentleman. Lord Fairfax first developed a reputation for his taste in literature while a student at Oxford. Living in London after college, he moved in the best literary circles. Andrew Burnaby said he contributed articles to The Spectator. Burnaby's statement has never been substantiated, but it does support his lordship's general association with quality literature. Though few surviving documents reveal the extent of Lord Fairfax's writing, much evidence shows the extent of his reading. Taken together, subscription lists, his estate inventory, and known volumes from his library present a vivid picture of his literary world. The subscription lists, for example, hint that he read ancient classics in English translation, biography, devotional literature, essays, history, and natural history. Before studying Lord Fairfax's love of books any further, a question. Do subscription lists really indicate the literary tastes of their subscribers? Not all the books Lord Fairfax subscribed to are known, but those that are reveal a pattern. The earliest book he subscribed to was The History of Kent by the encyclopedist John Harris. When this book appeared in 1719, Fairfax, one of the most prominent citizens in Kent, was almost duty-bound to subscribe to such a local history, regardless whether he intended to read it. Most of the other English books Lord Fairfax subscribed to appeared during the 8-year period he spent in London, awaiting the Lords of Trade and the Privy Council to validate his claims regarding the boundaries of the Northern Neck Proprietary. With spare time on his hands, he immersed himself in London's literary scene. When Lord Fairfax subscribed to the Reverend Dr. Leonard Twells's 24 Sermons, which Twells had presented as Boyle Lectures in the late 1730s, he requested the more expensive Royal Paper edition. His request indicates the pleasure luxurious objects gave him. Royal Paper, a type of large format paper that created stately volumes with wide, creamy margins, provided a way to enhance a book's physical appearance. Though it is tempting to see the books Lord Fairfax subscribed to as reflections of his literary taste, they clash with inferences drawn from his estate inventory. Those who inventoried estates in the 18th century often recorded individual book titles. Whoever inventoried Lord Fairfax's estate followed the practice, listing the titles of the books in his library at the time of his death. The inventory lists none of the London imprints he subscribed to. If his lordship cared so much for his subscription copies, why didn't he keep them? Lord Fairfax must have left his books in England when he moved to Virginia. Well, that is the most obvious theory. But it does seem strange that a literary man permanently moving to colonial America, a land where books were sometimes hard to come by, would leave his library behind him. Besides, this theory cannot account for the absence of one book Lord Fairfax subscribed to while living in Virginia, Griffith Hughes's Natural History of Barbados, a folio adorned with many handsome engravings. In contrast, Colonel Fairfax, who also subscribed to Hughes's Natural History, kept his copy all his life. Subscription copies may indicate a subscriber's literary tastes, but there were many possible reasons why someone in the 18th century might subscribe to a book, not all of which involved reading. The subscription list in Hughes's Natural History reveals the social contexts of literary subscription. Hughes's list of subscribers contains a special section, Subscribers from Virginia. The rector of St. Lucie Parish in Barbados, Hughes published the book himself and financed its publication by arranging as many subscriptions as possible. He deliberately sought out the wealthiest and most powerful Virginians to support his venture. As word went round Virginia, subscribing to Hughes's Natural History of Barbados became a sign of social prestige. Ultimately, 33 Virginians subscribed. When Hughes published the book, he organized the list of British subscribers alphabetically, but ranked the Virginia subscribers in order of social class, Lord Fairfax's name coming first. Securing his lordship's commitment, Hughes gave the project an aura of prestige that helped him gather more Virginia subscribers. Far from being a gauge of reading tastes, a list of subscribers was a reflection of social status, something to keep in mind when it comes to analyzing books Washington subscribed to as well. The list of Virginia subscribers to Hughes's Natural History of Barbados not only reads like a who's who in the colony, it also reads like a who's where in the social order. As a member of both the Fairfax family and the Virginia Council, Colonel Fairfax came second, followed by John Robinson, president of the council. Sadly, Robinson passed away before Hughes's book appeared. The Reverend Dr. William Dawson, a member of the council and president of the College of William and Mary, came fourth. The remaining 29 names appear in the following order: colonels, majors, esquires, and misters. Though the absence of Lord Fairfax's subscription copies from the estate inventory could indicate that he left them in England, the absence of Hughes's Natural History suggests an alternate fate for the missing books. So, too, does the absence of another book from Lord Fairfax's library that survived into the 20th century, a copy of Robert Beverley's History of Virginia, inscribed by its author. Here's a new theory. Lord Fairfax magnanimously presented many of his books to Virginia friends and neighbors before his death. When he died in 1781, his library contained 131 volumes, more than most private libraries in Virginia, but far fewer than the best. Roughly speaking, the books in Lord Fairfax's library at his death fall into two categories: reference works and pleasure reading. Perhaps both can be subsumed into one general category: books he could read repeatedly. The largest work at Greenway Court was the 20-volume Universal History, which may seem dry as dust by its title, but which offered Lord Fairfax and his house guests much pleasure reading. George Saintsbury found the Universal History full of good matter well put, and said, "One might be very happy with it, the standard test, in the country inn on wet afternoons." Lord Fairfax also owned at least two different collections of Virginia laws and two copies of Philip Miller's Gardener's Dictionary, an authoritative work Washington would add to his agricultural collection. In addition, Fairfax had several volumes recording the names of government officials throughout Great Britain and its colonies and documenting political activity in the metropolis. The remainder of Lord Fairfax's library is belletristic in nature. He had Jonathan Swift's works in 13 volumes, and if those were not enough, a copy of the Earl of Orrery's Remarks on the Life and Writings of Dr. Jonathan Swift, a work suggesting he took an interest in literary criticism, too. Confirming his critical interests, the works of Nicolas Boileau de Préau, France's foremost literary critic of the 17th century, also graced the shelves of Greenway Court. Lord Fairfax owned many novels, including some of the century's best. Though his subscriber's copy of Henry Fielding's Miscellanies disappeared before his death, he acquired three novels by the same author and one by his sister Sarah Fielding. He also had a copy of Tobias Smollett's Adventures of Peregrine Pickle, two novels by Charlotte Lennox, and many anonymous novels. Like the reference books that remained with them until his lordship's death, these novels were works he could read over and over again. When Washington visited Greenway Court in 1748, Lord Fairfax's library remained fairly modest. He could not have had Peregrine Pickle, first published in 1751, but he could have had Henry Fielding's Joseph Andrews, first published in 1742. Since so many of the novels at Greenway Court date from the early 1750s, they suggest that within a half dozen years after settling in Virginia, Lord Fairfax was busy constructing a literary world for himself in the Shenandoah. Lord Fairfax's portrait, painted late in life, confirms this view. He appears with a book in his hand, his right thumb holding his place midway through the volume. His physical position conveys his impatience with the portrait painter. "Hurry up and finish painting," he seems to say, "so I can get back to my book." Lord Fairfax represented for Washington a man who made literature a vital part of his life. Washington recorded his 1748 trip to Greenway Court in a pocket notebook, which he continued to use for miscellaneous memoranda upon returning home. Two consecutive notes he made concern his reading. "I read to the reign of King John," he wrote first, followed by, "In the Spectator's read to number 143. The earlier note initially seems too vague to identify. The second reflects Washington's characteristic precision. In the edition of The Spectator he owned, the 1745 Glasgow edition, essay number 143 appears partway through the second volume. So Washington read through the first volume and liked the work well enough to start the second. Presumably he read the other volumes another time, or at least dipped into them occasionally. Isaac Watts found all 8 volumes of The Spectator filled with so many valuable remarks for our conduct in life that they are not improper to lie in parlors or summer houses or places of usual residence to entertain our thoughts in any moments of leisure or vacant hours that occur. The Spectator contained much to allure Washington. Working together to create this essay series, Joseph Addison and Richard Steele invented a charming persona to comment on current events and observe contemporary behavior. Mr. Spectator is a keen-eyed London observer who describes what he sees with amusement and gently castigates what deserves castigating. Besides being a good observer, he is also a good listener. Well-read and well-traveled, he retains a thirst for knowledge. He is both self-confident and convivial. The coffee house is his office and his clubroom, the place where he makes friends and tests out ideas. The first 143 numbers contain some of the best writing in the series. Topics covered include public credit, number 3, popular superstition, number 7, and the meaning of wit, number 35. Spectator number 25 retells the fable of Jupiter and the countryman. To reward the countryman for his piety, Jupiter promises him whatever he wishes. The countryman wishes to control the weather on his own estate. Jupiter agrees, and the countryman distributes rain, snow, and sunshine around his farms as he sees fit. At the year's end, he discovers his harvest is much smaller than that of his neighbors, so he asks Jupiter to retake control of the weather before he ruins himself. Washington remembered what he read in The Spectator. During the Revolutionary War, he would recall this fable as a lesson against depending on Providence to grant the Continental Army's wishes. "Providence has done, and I am persuaded is disposed to do, a great deal for us, but we are not to forget the fable of Jupiter and the countrymen." Several numbers of The Spectator feature Sir Roger de Coverley, who belongs to the same club as Mr. Spectator. Sir Roger usually lives in the country but comes to London sporadically to enjoy the club life and experience what the city has to offer. Pleasant, obliging, easygoing, mirthful, he also possesses a wealth of common sense. Though a fictional character, Sir Roger gave Washington another model of the ideal country gentleman. Sir Roger does have his weaknesses, however. He is especially sensitive when it comes to matters of the heart, as Spectator number 113 indicates. One day, Mr. Spectator and Sir Roger are walking through some woods near the De Coverley estate. Sir Roger grows melancholy as they proceed, admitting that years earlier he used to visit this part of the woods to think about the young widow who had broken his heart. When Sir Roger's thoughts now turn to her, he again becomes obsessed and almost starts raving about the woman he once loved. Mr. Spectator feels helpless as he watches his friend descend into a near-manic state of obsession. To close the essay, Mr. Spectator finds one of Marshall's epigrams appropriate. Let Rufus weep, rejoice, stand, sit, or walk, still he can nothing but of Nevia talk. Let him eat, drink, ask questions, or dispute, still he must speak of Nevia or be mute. He writ his father, ending with this line, I am, my lovely Nevia, ever thine. This essay has often been read as an object lesson in the dangers of falling in love. Washington did not necessarily interpret it as such, or if he did, he also recognized other ramifications. He interpreted it as a lesson on the dangers of one man's becoming obsessed with an idea and being unable to break his obsession or see another's point of view. Washington would remember Marshall's lines from The Spectator and apply them many years later. By Spectator number 122, Sir Roger has recovered his equanimity. He and Mr. Spectator once again find themselves traveling through the countryside near the De Coverley estate. They encounter two men arguing over the right to fish a nearby stream. Given his local leadership and reputation for justice, Sir Roger agrees to mediate their dispute. After hearing both sides, he concludes, with the air of a man who would not give his judgment rashly, that much might be said on both sides. Returning to his estate at the day's end, Sir Roger and Mr. Spectator stop for refreshments at a local inn. The innkeeper, previously a servant in Sir Roger's household, has honored his former employer by creating a sign in his likeness, the sign of the Knight's Head. Sir Roger politely explains that the sign is inappropriate, so the innkeeper quickly repaints it, modifying the facial features, adding some whiskers, and rechristening it the Saracen's Head. To some eyes, Sir Roger's face remained discernible beneath the Saracen's. Sir Roger frankly asks Mr. Spectator what he sees as he looks at the sign, his head or the Saracen's. Mr. Spectator hems and haws, but pressed for an answer, he responds, much might be said on both sides. The phrase that Sir Roger articulates and Mr. Spectator repeats would come to exemplify Washington's approach to conflict, to weigh two opposing sides of an issue and see the positive aspects of both. Spectator number 122 demonstrates the pleasurable utility of such periodical essays. Washington liked The Spectator well enough to add another major periodical essay series to his personal library, The Guardian. The handwriting style of the ownership inscription in his copy suggests that Washington acquired The Guardian when he was around 17. Also written by Addison and Steele, The Guardian is second only to The Spectator in the history of British periodical essays. The Guardian explores charity, honor, justice, knowledge, and many other ideas central to contemporary conduct literature. This particular edition of The Guardian has an excellent index, which enhances the usefulness of the work, transforming it into a handy reference. Guardian number 161, for instance, is indexed under the word honor. The index assigns this essay a title, A Discourse Upon True Honor. Guardian number 161 observes, the sense of honor is of so fine and delicate a nature that it is only to be met with in minds which are naturally noble, or in such as have been cultivated by great examples or refined education. Like so much else that Washington read in his late teens, The Guardian emphasized the importance of examples for developing worthy personal qualities. Washington took to heart what The Guardian had to say. His sense of honor would become a defining personal characteristic. Since Washington noted precisely where he stopped reading The Spectator, the note he made about reading English history seems vague in comparison. Actually, it's not. His note about reading To the Reign of King John may seem to refer to almost any history of England, but it is nearly as specific as Washington's reference to reading The Spectator. The Reign of King John is the title of a chapter in Richard Baker's Chronicle of the Kings of England. Washington did not mention Baker's title in his notebook because he did not need to. It was the most popular history of England in the early 18th century. Baker's Chronicle first appeared in 1693 and went through 11 editions to 1733. The work became a fixture in homes across Great Britain and throughout the colonies. Henry Fielding called it the great favorite of my youth. In The Spectator, Sir Roger de Coverley keeps a copy of Baker's Chronicle prominently displayed in his hall window. He reads the work often and draws pertinent observations from it. Virginia gentlemen followed Sir Roger's lead. William Byrd II, for instance, had a copy in his library at Westover and drew many observations from it. Baker offered Washington much in terms of information, outlook, and example. Opening with a description of the earliest known times in Britain, he imposed a scholarly rigor on his materials, discounting quasi-fictional accounts and excluding such stuff which may please children but not riper judgments. The story of King Arthur, whose life has been more highly embellished than that of any other English king, Baker told in a single paragraph. He ignored the rich legends surrounding King Arthur's life, but honored him for instituting the Knights of the Round Table, which effectively eliminated all questions concerning precedence, teaching heroical minds not to stand upon place, but merit. King Alfred, in contrast, receives much more attention. In the face of hardship, Alfred spent his time learning policy from adversity and gathering courage from misery. He had great discipline, dividing the day into three equal periods, one for contemplation, reading, and prayer, another for health and recreation, and the last for affairs of state. Baker praised Alfred for his piety and his learning. Alfred encouraged the development of education to make sure British youth would be trained to know God, to be men of understanding, and to live happily. Starting with William the Conqueror, from whom all subsequent British kings have descended, Baker devoted separate chapters to each. Like Alfred, King William appears as an ideal ruler. After proving himself a valiant general in war, he became a provident governor in peace. While praising King William, Baker did not hesitate to critique some of his actions. Requiring all legal documents to be written in French upon a pretense to dignify the French tongue, William really sought to entrap men through ignorance of the language. Law French, as it became known, would remain the language of the British legal system for centuries. In other legal matters, however, King William was exemplary. He was the one, Baker asserted, who brought in the trial by the verdict of 12 men. It is not hard to see why Washington stopped reading Baker's Chronicle where he did. The chapter before The Reign of King John relates the life and reign of King Richard I, which reads like a comedy of errors. Soon after ascending to the throne, Richard led 30,000 men on a crusade to the Holy Land, an enormously expensive endeavor that stretched Britain's finances thin. Taken prisoner in Europe on his return journey, Richard required Britain to pay an exorbitant ransom for his release, virtually exhausting the nation's greatly depleted coffers. Toward the conclusion of the chapter, Baker incongruously praises King Richard. Explaining why he was known as Richard the Lionheart, Baker calls him valiant, but also stresses his fairness, mercy, piety, and wisdom. Inadvertently, the chapter contrasts King Richard's self-centered actions during his life and his posthumous reputation for courage and wisdom. This disparity appears to have been too much for George Washington to stomach. After reading about Richard the Lionheart, he quit reading Baker's Chronicle altogether. Washington continued enlarging his personal library in his teens. In 1747, he purchased from his kinsman Bailey Washington a 50-year-old pamphlet, Hippolyte du Chasselet de Lusancy's Panegyric to the Memory of His Grace Frederick, late Duke of Schoenberg. Considered one of the finest military minds of the 17th century, the Duke of Schoenberg, as his name is typically spelled, gave Washington an example of another leader devoted to his principles. Schoenberg established his reputation as a marshal in the French army, but when France revoked the Edict of Nantes, Schoenberg left for Berlin, where he became the leader of the Huguenot refugees. When the Prince of Orange made his famous expedition to England in 1688, Schoenberg joined him as second-in-command. He served the remainder of his life as a general in the English army. The panegyric reminded Washington of his educational deficiencies. "Education makes us truly what we are," de Lusancy observed, calling it the foundation of great actions. Washington may not have been able to match Schoenberg's education, but he could aspire to his physical prowess. De Lusancy continued, "He had a robust and strong body, capable of the greatest hardships. He was naturally active, a great lover of exercise, healthful and temperate to admiration. He neither courted nor feared danger, ever himself, ever fortunate, ever preventing the worst and surmounting the greatest difficulties." These words sound almost like a description of George Washington. De Lusancy also had great respect for Schoenberg's sense of responsibility. "His duty was his greatest passion, and the discharge of the noble trusts put into his hands his only pleasure." One additional piece of evidence verifies Washington's ongoing respect for the Duke of Schoenberg. He named a slave Schoenberg. Though the act of naming a slave scarcely sounds like an honor, it was not uncommon for Virginia slaveholders to name slaves after figures from history they respected. Washington had another slave named Caesar. The evidence suggests that the teenage Washington enjoyed reading, but he did not spend all his time at Belvoir with his nose stuck in a book. Far from it. He was quite smitten with a young female member of the Fairfax family, presumably Mary Carey, George William Fairfax's sister-in-law. "This very agreeable young lady," Washington told a friend, "in a great measure cheers my sorrow and dejectedness." Mary was one of several girls on whom Washington set his heart in his boyhood, a group that also included Frances Alexander and a young woman known only to history as the Lowland Beauty. It may seem incongruous to picture George Washington as a love-struck teen, but, like young Roger de Coverley's, his heart was apparently quite fragile in his youth. When a pretty girl rebuffed him, Washington turned away from love and looked toward loftier pursuits, until the next pretty girl came along. Two love poems, or to be precise, two attempts at love poetry, survive among the miscellaneous notes Washington kept in the late 1740s. His editors question whether he wrote them, though they contain imagery and diction characteristic of much Augustan verse. More and more the poems seem like his compositions. The speaker of the first poem, having surrendered to Cupid's feathered dart, is left bleeding in the face of a pitiless lover. At night he seeks soft, lulling sleep and gentle repose, through which he may possess those joys denied by day. The second poem is an acrostic to Frances Alexander, the first letter of each line formed from her name. Washington made it through the hardest line, X, but abandoned the task after one more line, leaving the last four letters of her name without corresponding lines of verse. For the X line, he referred to the wealthy Persian ruler Xerxes, who was not free from Cupid's dart. Perhaps Washington's reuse of the Cupid cliché helped him realize he was not cut out for poetry. Despite their mediocrity, these poems reveal that Washington recognized poetry as a way of articulating emotion. His reference to Xerxes now seems the most significant aspect of these poems, at least in terms of Washington's personal outlook. Best known for his invasion of Greece, Xerxes and his massive Persian army came up against the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae. Led by Leonidas, the Spartans resisted Persian advances for 3 days straight and were only defeated when a traitor led the Persians down a secret path. Technically, Xerxes won the battle, but the 300 Spartans are remembered for their bravery, dedication, and fortitude. Herodotus's history provides the fullest account of Xerxes's invasion of Greece. Washington reveals his familiarity with the invasion elsewhere in his papers. During the Revolutionary War, he used Leonidas as the parole one night and Thermopylae another. Washington also named one of his horses Leonidas. Xerxes's defeats actually provide more valuable lessons than his victories. All Xerxes's riches could not defeat a nation with superior knowledge of war and naval expertise. The story of Xerxes's ultimate defeat encouraged Washington to further his own knowledge of war. Washington's personal contact with the Fairfaxes in his mid to late teens and the books he read at that age influenced him similarly. Much as Lord Fairfax and Colonel Fairfax provided models for him to emulate, the books Washington read provided many exemplary figures on which he could pattern his life. Eliza Haywood suggested that books, especially history books, help us discover which behaviors to emulate and which to avoid. In the character of Sir Roger de Coverley, the Spectator provided the model of the British country gentleman. And in the works of Baker, de Lusancy, and Herodotus, Washington could read about different leaders and styles of leadership. The men Washington met, and those he read about in his teens, would significantly shape the man he would become.